You're asking about the advisability of pushing yourself.
And also, for example, I noticed that I wanted to push myself, and then I set, you know, something in the future that I needed to reach, and then that actually is causing, you know, causing me to look in the future, which is not a good thing, right? So I made myself kind of let go of that.
Yeah. Well, the desire to be successful in your practice, the desire to become enlightened, as long as you are still subject to desire, that's the best kind of desire to have. Where it gets in your way is when you become attached to it. And that's what you have to watch out for. As far as pushing yourself, in terms of sitting for an extra couple of hours, or maybe sitting through for a longer period of time, that's a very good thing to do. What you want to watch out for is sometimes you can reach a point of diminishing returns. You'll find that the meditation is going less and less well, and you're having more and more difficulty just trying to stay with the practice. And at that point, you might be well advised to not sit further and take a walking meditation, or if you're sitting late at night, to go ahead and go to bed, something like that. But unless something like that happens, it's obviously going to be to your benefit to do that exercise. So pushing yourself in that way is good. If you find yourself becoming attached to some idea of what you want to achieve or attain, you should mindfully examine that attitude when you discover the present and try to let go of it. You should notice how that attitude very, very quickly leads to feeling of frustration, restlessness, disappointment, self-judgment, all of these negative states that are very counterproductive. So if it comes up, it's an opportunity to look at it and to recognize the harm that it can cause and to let go of it. So, does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Did you have something that you wanted to say?
Yes. We were wondering, Petronia has a new camera lens, and she's got, you know, quite a nice camera. She was wanting to take some photographs tomorrow, not in the meditation hall, but maybe as people are walking and doing their exercises or maybe enjoying some food. Is there anybody who would object to having their photo taken and won't take a picture of them? And we would put some of those photos up on our website.
Does this mean I have to shave?
No.
Well, nobody minds some candid photographs while you're
walking.
Yes,
sort of not post photos, sort of, yeah, you know, just people doing their thing.
Probably you should ask, is there anyone that who like more photos?
Well, and on Monday we could do posed photos.
On Monday we'll do some other photos. But tomorrow we don't want to interfere with anybody's practice. Yeah. Okay,
perfect. Okay, good. All right. Photos out of the way. Let's get back to meditation. Meditation and Dharma. So, do you have some other questions that have come up as well? Yes, Michael.
Yeah. Sometimes the breath is not very pleasant, and it's not as easy to pay attention to. What are some of the ways that we can improve our concentration and awareness when the breath is kind of unpleasant? Sometimes I think there's some kind of blockage here.
Tell me.
Not very.
Good. Can you describe to me in what way it's unpleasant?
Just doesn't feel good.
The sensations themselves.
Sensation doesn't feel good, and it's easy. It's harder to pay attention to. Like when the breath is comfortable, it's easy to pay attention to. But then if it's not comfortable, then the mind kind of has this resistance of, you know, trying to pay a lot of attention to it.
And this is the sensations of the breath at the nose that you're finding are uncomfortable, or?
Yeah, Yeah, in general.
Yeah.
Okay. In general.
Well, sometimes it does happen, and maybe you've all experienced this, I don't know. Your mind becomes very sharp, very clear, very sensitive. And so even though your breath is very shallow and very light, the feelings of the movement of the air in and out of your nose can be very intense. And it can sometimes happen that they're so intense that you feel like you almost can't stand it. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Sometimes, yeah. It feels like it's burning.
Yeah, it feels like it's on fire, or almost like the skin is peeled away. It's just raw nerves that the air is going over. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that happens to me, and when it does, I usually think something like, how nice it is that my mind has become so sensitive to the sensations that I can experience them all with such intensity and vividness. And then there's two things that I would do, two possible things that I would do. In one case, I would try to go into those sensations in even more detail and take that as an opportunity to experience the most subtle level of the sensations. The most subtle level of sensations is just, it's like a vibration, and it becomes unrecognizable. You can't even recognize it as breath sensation anymore. And you can have a direct experience of impermanence as a result of that. You know, you can also have an experience of emptiness as a result of that, because the sensations will simply dissolve into this indescribable vibratory phenomena, and your mind will sort of jump back from that to try to make those sensations recognizable again, to get on the solid ground of, oh yeah, that's it feels like the breath again, it's familiar, it feels like coolness or warmth or pressure or movement or something like that. And when that happens, if you allow that to happen, and then you watch the mind's reaction to it, and you let it happen again, and you keep watching how your mind reacts to it, what you see there is, the reality is that there are just pure sensations, and it's my mind that constructs reality out of that. And so you actually are having an experience of impermanence and emptiness. So that's one way to go with it. In other words, just go into it and see how far it will take you. The other thing that you can do is to go just in the opposite direction and step back from that and open your awareness up so that you're not so closely focused on the breath anymore. And begin to feel the breath over a larger area, not just the nose, but the nose and the chest and the abdomen. And not trying to capture every little detail of it, but just sort of observing it more from a distance. It's already really familiar, so you can just watch it in a more relaxed way from a distance over a larger area. And that will become much more comfortable to do. So if I have correctly identified the sensations you're talking about, that's how I would deal with them.
Great, thank you.
Okay. But they're actually, to have that experience, that is a good sign. It's a sign of the acuity of your conscious awareness has become very enhanced.
Yeah. Is this applied to other sensation which is very strong?
To which sensation? To
the other stronger sensation.
That this happens? As a matter of fact, it does.
No. This, while you describe, there are two ways to deal with.
Oh, yes. To deal, that's right.
Is that applied to other strong sensation that
yes.
Seems that you cannot handle?
Yes. Yes.
Right?
You can use the same two methods. If there are strong sensations, really strong sensations, really intense sensations that are making you feel uncomfortable in some way, then these are two very effective ways of dealing with them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have kind of the opposite question. If you're trying to feel the sensations of the breath in the nose area and there's hardly any sensation, and it's very hard to pay attention when there's hardly any sensation. So I wonder what you suggest for that.
Yes, that sometimes happens too, is that it seems like you lose the sensations, or sometimes it's almost like your mind forgets where to look for the sensations, and you can't quite find them. So what I would suggest that you do with that is you will still usually, of the breath cycle, there will still be some parts of it that are still clear and recognizable. So you just keep practicing looking for the missing pieces, you know, looking to fill in the gaps in your experience and enhance your awareness there. Check to see if it's a kind of dullness. So if there's a kind of dullness present, then do something to brighten your mind up and energize your mind.
What are some ways to energize your mind?
You see, the way that our minds slip into dullness is we become so focused on one thing that we cease being aware of other things. And so there's not as much stimulation to our actual physical brain when we become too focused. And so the energy level of the mind begins to fall. So one of the things that you can do when you feel like there's that kind of dullness is that you can expand your awareness. You know, similar to what I said a moment ago, instead of just keeping the awareness here, expand it to include the chest and the abdomen and the other sensations of the breath. But you could go beyond that, and you can just the sensations, any of the sensations in your body, or expand your awareness to include sound, things like that. You could forget about the breath and just expand your awareness to, you know, hear the sounds of birds outside, or sounds that are in the room, things like that. That's one way. Another way, of course, is to open your eyes and meditate with your eyes open or half open. And that will help to energize the mind. And then other ways are what I mentioned the other night, when the dullness is strong, to take a deep breath, let it out slowly, and repeat that 3, 4, 5 times. And as you do, each time if you take a deep breath and then you let it out slowly against some resistance in your lips, try and make noise and disturb everybody else. But when you do that, you should feel almost a rush of energy go up to your spine, to your head, and make you more alert. And the other one is to clench your muscles and relax them. Do repeat that a number of times. Tighten every muscle in your body, just hold it till you begin to shake, and then let go of it all at once. And repeat that a few times. These are really standard, easy to do sort of ways to overcome dullness and re-energize your mind and make yourself more alert again. But the disappearance of sensations, sometimes the sensitivity of your mind doesn't keep up with the degree to which your breath slows down. And don't you find it amazing when you're in deep concentration how small your each breath is and how slow they are? I sometimes think, how is it that my body can get enough oxygen with so little breathing? You know, because the breath does become very, very fine. Well, sometimes as you concentrate and as the mind becomes still, the breath slows down, becomes very, very shallow, becomes fine to the degree that the sensations are very mild, not very prominent. And if the perceptual acuity, you know, if the ability of your mind to grasp those very subtle sensations hasn't kept up with the process, then you'll start experiencing those gaps. Like very often the out-breath is the one that will disappear first. You know, you maybe know when the out-breath begins, but then it just seems to disappear after that, and the next thing you know, the next in-breath is starting. And So that's the time that you would do what I suggested. Just keep, with each breath cycle, just each new breath is an opportunity to try to perceive those missing sensations this time. If you don't get them this time, the next breath you try. And that will actually keep you quite focused. It gives your mind something to do, looking for the missing sensation. If the dullness, if the dullness is there, you'll feel that you'll have that feeling like a vagueness or a haziness, or you can't quite make your mind be sharp enough to pick them up. And that's the time you use the other techniques to overcome dullness. Yes.
In the walking meditation, do you also observe your own sensation, or you observe the outside world, or how does that the sensation apply in the walking meditation?
In the walking meditation, what you want to do is to keep the focus of your attention on the walking and allow your mind to take in everything else, including other sensations in your body, as well as external things through your eyes and ears. And also, the instruction I gave you was to start off with primarily observing the sensations in the soles of your feet. You know, the change in sensation as your foot comes up, and then the sensations again as your foot comes down on the ground. But you can also, in the same way that you can expand the breath sensations to include the chest and the abdomen, you can expand the sensations that you observe in walking to include the feelings of as the muscles contract in your legs to lift and move your legs and these other bodily sensations as well. And as a matter of fact, I encourage you to experiment with these different things. And, you know, all of these things are part of learning how your mind works and training your mind. So when you experiment with walking in different ways, you should always be learning something new. And it should be with this attitude of, oh, this is interesting, and what can I learn from this?
Yeah, because in the sitting meditation, the stillness itself probably that you experience the breath and the yom sensation.
Yeah.
But in the walking meditation, you keep moving, right? And how, well, you still try to feel that stillness, mm-hmm. or like experience, because I can put two of this together to the experience, mm-hmm. or like feel the sensation. You know, you keep trying to feel that stillness, just like you say, probably it will sharpen like how you feel. But to put the two style meditation together, like the sitting meditation, and how the sitting meditation apply to that, still don't exactly pick that up. Mm-hmm.
The stillness aspect is what you're thinking of. Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. You see, there is a place that you can get to where you're just the observer. And the observer is in a place of perfect stillness. I call it the still point. And so your body is moving, and you're observing the body moving, but the feeling you have is that you're observing it from a place of perfect stillness. And the body is just moving outside of that place. As you do that, you notice your eyes moving. And you're just observing that your eyes are moving by themselves. And you're not reacting to any of this. You're not doing it. You're not making it happen. You observe all the sensations in your legs and your feet and in the rest of your body in the same way. And external sounds and things like that. you become like the completely passive passenger in your own body. And that extends to the mind as well. Because, of course, while you're doing walking meditation, your mind is still doing things, but you're watching thoughts arise and pass away, feelings arise and pass away, feelings in response to, you see something, you either like it or you don't, and you observe the feelings arise and pass away, but you still have that sense of being in a place of completely passive stillness. Wow. Your body is moving around you, and the world is changing around you. Yes, Mike?
What's the reason why during walking meditation we're switching our attention to the sensation of the steps instead of the breath? It will be just as easily done if we pay attention to the breath. Why are we paying attention to the sensation of the feet?
Why don't we pay attention to the sensation of the breath while we're walking?
Right. The focus of the attention. Why the feet and not the breath? And when we meditate.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is, if you think about it, the sensations associated with walking are much more predominant. You're much more aware of the walking just because they are larger movements, larger in magnitude, stronger feelings than breathing. And the second thing is that, is that it is the primary activity that your body is doing. And so you want to be really fully present. And since that's the main thing that your body is doing, why ignore it? There are walking meditation techniques that combine the breath with the walking. And so you're observing both at once. But in those methods, usually what you do is you try to make the breath coincide with the walking, so that you inhale in one step and exhale on the other, or something like that. And those, some people like those. I find those a little bit too contrived, and I find that the mindful awareness, a strong mindful awareness, the kind of mindful awareness that you want to have in your daily life, I find that develops more easily if I'm not trying to make one process correspond to another process and busy with that kind of doing.
And is it important to walk slowly? Because sometimes after you sit for a long time, you want a little bit of exercise, and when you walk very slowly, you're achieving very little of the exercise objective. So is it important that we walk slowly?
Yeah. You can walk at different speeds, and that's quite all right. How fast you walk isn't very important, how fast or how slow. So much as the quality of the attention and the quality of the awareness that is with that. The attention in the sense of what your mind is focused on, and the awareness in terms of everything else, including what's going on in your mind. So that's what's most important. Now, often what I do is I walk slowly for a while, and the sensations of walking will become very clear in my mind. And exactly what those sensations are, every time when my heel lifts up from the ground, the same sensations, same familiar sensations occur, maybe with some slight variation, but they keep repeating. And then as the rest of my foot comes up, and as my toe leaves the ground, is all familiar sensations happening again and again. So sometimes what I'll do is deliberately increase how fast I'm walking and try to be able to still track all of the same sensations that I was aware of when I was walking more slowly. And just keep increasing the speed with which I walk. So if you feel like, you know, if you feel like walking faster, go ahead and walk faster. If you can, you can practice mindfulness walking, even comparing what it is like to walk slowly as compared to what it is like to walk at a normal pace, and what is compared to, what it is like to walk at a rapid pace. Completely different feelings walking in these three different ways. If you walk slowly, you notice how it's not so automatic, and you have to have a lot of mindfulness, otherwise you tend to lose your balance when you're walking very slowly. You walk at a normal pace, the pace that we normally do, and it's almost completely automatic. Your mind can be 1,000 miles away, and the walking will happen just fine. The eyes will notice when you need to step one way or another to avoid stepping on something or bumping into something. And you can just intentionally change the rate of your walking so that you can observe that shift into a very automatic process, and how the mind is the mind becomes freed up, and as soon as the mind is freed up, there comes this temptation for the mind to start wandering and thinking about things and going somewhere else. And it's very illuminating just to do that on purpose and observe it. Then if you start walking quickly, once again, there's another shift that takes place, because to continue to walking swiftly requires maintaining the intention. Otherwise, your body's going to slow back down to sort of what we call the normal pace. And so you can kind of observe how that changes the way you walk. So to sum it all up, what I'm saying is that you have a lot of latitude in the walking meditation to experiment with the speed that you walk, to experiment with the sensations that you monitor, whether it's just the soles of your feet, or whether it's the movement of your legs, whether it's the muscles, whether it's the feeling of gravity as you're taking step after step. And none of these are a wrong way of meditating. As a matter of fact, they're all completely valid ways of practicing.
So when we are meditating, sitting down, we're allowing the natural breath to take place and just observe the breath. There's a little bit less intention involved, because you know when we walk, we have to have the intention of walking slowly, you know, maintaining balance, you know, using certain muscles here and there. So there's a lot more mentally involving. Can you tell us the strength, you know, in that practice? You know, we have to apply a lot more intention versus when we sit, there's the intention is just simply to observe the breath.
Yeah, when you're sitting, it's how to describe it. Everything is much more focused and slower when you're sitting, and so you have the opportunity to achieve the sort of maximum clarity of your awareness and maximum control over your attention. It's a different kind of to use a scientific terminology, it's like it's a different kind of laboratory. It's a laboratory where everything is much, much more controlled. You know? Whereas when you're out there doing walking meditation, it's more like you're out there studying what's happening in the world. You know, sort of the difference of being in a laboratory where everything's controlled on a bench, and you have complete control over everything that's happened. But if you go out in the world and you want to study whatever it is, animals, oceans, weather, you just have to take whatever comes and work with it as best you can.
So going back to the real world, just like you mentioned, the world keeps changing. you know. Mm-hmm. And in our daily life, probably each day you have 30 minutes to sit down to meditate, but you probably have 3 hours, you know, while you are working or in your office, in any kind of environment. Mm-hmm. You know, even though the world is moving, you can still practice like a walking meditation or certain kind of moving meditation. Right. But how do we apply that skills in the real world? Probably that's to transforming or like getting the sitting meditation applying to the moving or walking meditation.
And also along the lines of his question, sort of the idea of the be here now or the power of now, you know, how do we pull that in as well in the daily life or whatever?
So I think
and
the line of question is we're talking about for training purpose. This should be a difference between slow walking and the fast walking.
Yeah.
And we're talking about training purpose. Okay. And in terms of applied to real life, there's another skill. But if there's a difference, my personal experience is when you walk in slow, you more attention to your footstep sensation.
Yes.
Then your awareness on outside. Mm-hmm. And when you at some stage, when you walk fast, you don't so detail to attention the full step. You take the whole body movement as a whole.
That's
sensation.
Right. Yeah.
And combine balance with the awareness of the whole situation. So this is training purpose, this is different. At the beginning, I walk very slow.
Mm-hmm.
So attention to, as you said, but it's more difficulty. But as long as you get this, because slow walking is more focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
Then mindful awareness of the everything.
Mm-hmm.
But and more detail. But fast is take as whole, body movement as whole. So applied to real world, I think no matter you take a slow or take a fast, it's just how can you keep the attention and awareness
mm-hmm.
by either of the method.
Mm-hmm.
This is my experience. I don't know if it's right or not.
Well, all of these things are ways of training the abilities to meet different circumstances. Like when you walk quickly, yes, you can't pay attention. Everything happens too quickly to pay attention just to the soles of the feet. So the mind naturally shifts to something that is easier to get a hold of, which is the whole movement of the body. And this the same thing happens sometimes when you're in the world. Things are happening quickly and you can't focus with the same degree of detail, so you move up to a larger picture. You have to. I have no choice. Peter was really asking about, you know, how do we bring this? If I understand correctly, what are all the ways that we can use to bring this into our daily life? And there is a parallel in all of this. In the sitting meditation, when you first begin, the hardest part is not forgetting what it is you're doing. Because when you forget what you're doing, your mind wanders. In the walking meditation, you need to stay in the present. And the hard part is remembering to do that, because you start thinking about something, and you're still paying attention to your feet while you're walking, but at the same time, you're also thinking about something, and you have to remember, oh, okay, I'm staying in the present. I'll go in the past, I'll go in the future, and so forth. So in both of these situations, the first problem you come up with is remembering what you're doing. And this is the first problem you come up with when you want to practice mindful awareness in your life. It's just simply remembering to do it. That's going to be the biggest problem. You're going to you get up in the morning and say, well, okay, I'm going to try to be mindful as I can all day today. And then you might not think of it again until you wake up the next morning and say, well, wow, I completely forgot. Right? So it's all the same steps, and you deal with them the same way. You you want to remember to be mindfully aware during the day. But you're going to forget. But sooner or later, you will remember. And when you remember, you feel really good about remembering. And you remind yourself that, well, you know, I want to remember. And this will, in the same way that in the sitting practice and in the walking practice, you get better and better at it, the same thing will happen. There is one other thing you can do with bringing mindful awareness, with helping to remember to bring mindful awareness into your daily life. And that is intentionally reflecting. So if you say in the morning, I'm going to try to be mindful today, and then if you also plan that tonight at 7 o'clock, I'm going to sit down and just review how mindful I was today, then you might have forgotten all day long, but then you can remember, okay, when are the times that I could have been mindful? Well, this thing happened in the morning, I could have practiced mindful awareness. So you can actually be retroactively mindful. You can think, oh, well, when this thing happened and this person said that, you know, I should have been mindful, I should have noticed my reactions and so forth. If you do that, it's going to be more likely that next time something like that happens, you remember it more quickly. Perhaps you'll still remember it after it's already over with, but it might be 10 minutes after it's over with. And then if you keep doing that, then it might be while it's happening that you remember to be mindful. So the first thing is bringing the mindfulness into your daily life. By remembering, and it's just the same as remembering what it is you're intending to do. Then the other things you need to do are also parallel to the meditation situation. One of the things that happens in meditation is that we get sucked into some thought or some sensation, you know, some pain in our leg, something like that. And it takes up all of our attention. And the same thing happens in our daily lives. Something will happen and it takes up all of our attention and we totally forget to be aware of what's going on in our mind, to be aware of other things at the same time. So you have to practice the same thing. In meditation, you practice not forgetting, not allowing yourself to become so focused on the breath that you forget everything else, that you cease to be aware of everything else. Because you know if you do that, you're more likely to forget what you're doing and your mind is going to wander, or you're more likely to get into dullness. So you try to keep your attention centered without losing awareness of everything else. And you have to do the same thing in your daily life. Some situation comes up, you have to remember not to get so totally sucked into that situation that you lose track of what's going on in your own mind, you lose track of what's really happening with the people around you, and so forth. So, over and over again, what you'll find is that to be mindful in daily life requires essentially doing the same things that you do in the meditation practice. All of the meditation practice is, I mean, I guess that's why they call it practice. You're practicing for real life. The skills do carry over. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, that follow the same subject, like sitting meditation and walking meditation. From my experience, one of the teachers saying, sitting meditation is one kind of the, and moving qigong.
Moving qigong.
Yes, yeah. Because qi is circulation in your body.
Yeah.
But walking meditation is like moving qigong, just like tai chi. Mm-hmm. So when you concentrate, relax enough, actually when you're walking slowly, and it becomes like a key moving, not really you are walking, mm-hmm. something like that. So I don't know what you think about this kind of saying, because my experience, I do same way. I find out that's true that way too.
Well, I agree totally that, you know, the walking meditation is a form of qi meditation. Nancy mentioned Be Here Now. I think somebody's reading that book.
The Power of Now.
The Power of Now.
Or The Power of Now, yeah. Power of Now. That is that's all about being fully present and not getting lost in false ideas, useless beliefs, emotions, fantasies about the future, worries about the future, regrets about the past, wishing this was different, that was different. It's all about what we're trying to do, learning to be fully present, which allows you to become a far more capable person. And, you know, you can carry out functions that involve planning for the future and do it while being completely mindful and in the present. The problem is that when we lose the present, when we cease to be in the present moment, and then we lose perspective. We lose the sense of how things, we lose the sense of reality, you know. It's like we were talking about last night. You start thinking about all my future, my security, how much money I need to retire, and things like that. And if that's all you think about, you lose the perspective of your life you're living right now, your life today, your life this week, your relationship with your wife or husband or your children and so forth. And that's the kind of thing that it's not incompatible to have goals and to make plans and to carry out activities and do things in the world. That's not incompatible with being in the present. As a matter of fact, if you're in the present when you do it, you'll do it far more effectively. You'll do it with much more clarity and balance, perspective, the word I used before. You have the perspective that allows you to see how everything fits together. So you don't let your plans for the future, you know, as we know, some people will let their plans for the future actually destroy the very future they're planning for. Think about the wonderful retirement that they're going to have with their wife when they make this amount of money, except that they ignore their wife so much that they're not married anymore by the time they have that much money. So,
but how is that compatible? Because you have that goal, and that goal to a certain point probably is not achievable when you realize that. So by being now, probably you don't realize, because everyone wants to achieve something, probably, you know, that's his goal or his vision. Mm-hmm.
You make a goal, and that's a good thing to do. But if you stay in the present, you're always reaffirming that goal or revising that goal. If the goal becomes fixed and frozen and it can't change and you can't adapt, then it becomes a great burden, will make you blind to what's happening, and that's what you want to avoid. So goals are a good thing. For one thing, having a goal tells you, it allows you to know when you've achieved it, which I've known some people who, that was their main problem, that they didn't know when they had succeeded, they didn't know when to quit. You know, if you have a goal, and if it's realistic, then when you've accomplished it, then you're now free of that. It's time for you to create a new goal and to move towards something else. But goals should also be flexible. If you set yourself a goal and what's necessary to achieve that goal is going to have a very deleterious effect on your life in the present. I mean, you know, another example is you could work so hard to achieve a goal that you destroy your health so that you're not even around to reap the benefits of that goal. Being more fully present, you won't make that mistake. You know, you'll recognize that, okay, goals sound good back then, but now it needs to be changed, it needs to be revised to fit the present circumstances.
So does the meditation will help yourself to plan for the future, or how does that the meditation apply in terms of that setting your own goal or your own vision? You know?
What it does is meditation helps to make you aware of what's happening right now, so that you can set your goals and modify your goals on the basis of that.
But you were talking, you said something like Eckhart Tolle's the power of now and being present makes you a more capable person. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that, I mean, he's talking about the power of now is a gateway to liberation. I mean, it's far more than let's just be capable people.
It's not just about making you more capable. And meditation is not just about making you more effective in life. It's not just about making you happier, which it does do that. It does make you more effective. It does make you happier. But it's also about something much more than that. These are all, as a matter of fact, all these things that we've just been talking about are kind of like the incidental benefits, the extra bonuses that come along the way. You know, the rewards you get for doing the practice is that you have more happiness, you're more effective, you're more successful, you make better decisions, you have better relationships with people. You, in general, you get along better in life. But the goal really is deep down what you want. Is you want a sense that you know what your life is about, and you know who you are, and why you're living, what the meaning of all this is. Why am I here? It's the spiritual answer, it's the liberation. And what we're looking for is the liberation from all of these worldly concerns. The wonderful thing is that in the process of moving towards liberation from worldly concerns, we at the same time become more effective in dealing with worldly concerns. And that's why an enlightened person or a Buddha is not an incapable person. They're a very capable person. But they choose their direction and they choose their purpose and they act out of that. They're liberated from all of the sorts of compulsions and drives that ordinary people are subject to. That's my...
For a person practicing the Dharma, the clarity of... this person gaining better and better clarity, and then you know, finding liberation it's not even a matter of choice, because there's simply no other alternative other than seeking liberation. So as we gain more and more clarity, we see that certain behaviors cause suffering, and certain behaviors cause wholesome outcomes, and then we naturally it becomes that we have no choice but to it's kind of like on this autopilot where we have to be liberated. There's no other choice.
Yes, you're right. And you know, the way I would put that is we grow spiritually. So long before we become a Buddha, we are growing, and we are becoming a more powerfully spiritual being all the way along. Until you reach the point where, what are you going to do? Go back?
Because everybody wants happiness, and everybody, you know, the clearer that we understand things, you know, the more we're going to behave in lines with the Dharma.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like there's a choice, you know. I mean, if people want to practice, you know, and everybody wants happiness, and you know, it becomes kind of like it's not a matter of choice anymore.
That's true. You know, and there should be a warning on the package. A warning on the package that says, if you keep practicing this path, you're going to reach a point where it's more important than everything else, and everything else just becomes a means to that end. That's the warning that should be on there.
Would you elaborate more on that?
Well, it is in this process, as your understanding deepens, you know, and as you develop mindful awareness, and as you become aware of your own nature, it allows you to resolve a lot of the problems that you have in your life. But it gives you a clarity about the way things really are, that you want more. You want to continue with that, and it becomes the most important thing of all. You know, I reached a point in my life where it was the only thing. And it is still the only thing that really matters to me, and absolutely everything else that I do is a part of that in one way or another. And I've gone to an extreme compared to many other people because, you know, I've given up a lot of the other preoccupations in my life, which is really the idea behind, you know, somebody becoming a bhikkhu or a monk or something like that. They give up the world and dedicate themselves totally to spiritual practice. But I see other people that don't perhaps go as far as I have done, but still, you know, they have a family and they have a career, but every decision they make about their career is, how is this going to benefit my spiritual path? You know, and some other people may look at the decisions they make and say, you're crazy, you should have taken a promotion and moved to New York. But they said, no, this other thing is more important. So, you know, whatever it is. And that's the way it is. All of the other aspects of your life, at some point, it'll sneak up on you, but at some point, it's the most important thing. And you just really don't have time to be concerned with anything else. It also affects who you associate with. You'll find that there are some people that you don't have anything in common with anymore. And so those relationships will fall away. And instead, you will associate with those people who share your ideas and your goal and your desire for spiritual growth. And that's very important because they benefit you enormously. One very famous sutra, Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin, but he was also his attendant.
Ananda
said, it's true, is it not, that good companions is half of the spiritual life? And the Buddha said, no, Ananda. Good companions are the whole of the spiritual life. And by good companions, actually, you know, that people who are on the same spiritual path. So, yeah, should be a warning on the box.
Is it possible to experience or explore the power of now without practice meditation?
Without practicing meditation? Yes?
I can ask this question differently.
Okay.
Is the meditation practice is the most powerful way to explore the power now?
Yes, it is.
And without it, it's possible to achieve it.
It is possible without it, yes. But it's enormously more likely...
But if it's possible without it, the other way should be something similarly mm-hmm. with the practice of meditation. What is that?
Without
meditation, it's possible, right?
Yeah.
So the other way should be something similarly, have some concept or something similar with the meditation, then can achieve it.
Mm-hmm. Well, take Eckhart Tolle, for example, who wrote the book Power of Now.
Mm-hmm. Victoria.
He didn't meditate.
Yeah, he didn't meditate.
He did not.
I know he did not.
Yeah. Although he meditates now.
Yes.
But he didn't meditate. What he did that led him to his awakening and to his experience was he was in deep depression for several years. Deep, total depression. So deep that something switched inside his mind. But if you think about it, how many people in this world are in deep depression? And how many of them
awaken? He's exceptional.
He's an exception.
He's opposite way. Do this first and do meditation later.
Right. Another example, I can't remember the name, but there is a famous Jewish man who wrote books who became enlightened, became awakened in a German concentration camp during World War II. But 6 million other people died in the gas chambers, and many survived, and most of them didn't become awakened as a result of it. So there are other things that can bring a person to awakening, but not with the degree of reliability and consistency as meditation. That's really my point. It's not the only way.
Yeah, no.
Some people would say, oh, it's the only way. I know better than that. It's not the only way. But it is the most powerful way. And then you find somebody like Eckhart Tolle. He becomes awakened, and then he starts to meditate.
So what's the point of meditation after enlightenment? I mean, he's already enlightened.
Well,
because you meditate to acquire a skill to achieve enlightenment.
Okay, I don't know. When I become completely and totally enlightened, I'll know and I'll tell you. In the meantime, all I know is the Buddha continued to meditate. And
it feels good.
In my experience, the more I meditate, the better things get, so I'm not going to quit. Maybe there isn't an end. Maybe even when you become a Buddha, there's still farther than you can go. I don't know.
Can't you just kind of keep exploring further?
Yeah.
It's infinite, right?
Just keep on going. As a matter of fact, I could care less if there's any end. The journey is wonderful. But just stay on the journey. And don't worry about getting to an end. As a matter of fact, it might be disappointing. That's it. It's over with. Nothing left.
How about in a certain situation, you just occupied by something else, you couldn't meditate or just calm down for one day? What would happen?
Take a break.
what would happen?
Whether you're running from the enemy or what you're running.
Okay, who? You mean me personally?
I just want to see.
Oh. If I couldn't meditate for a day, it wouldn't make that much difference. If I couldn't meditate for a long period of time, there are some ways it would make a difference, but there's other things that just won't change. Okay? So it's like, there is, the PT that I talked about, the joy and the happiness that comes from meditation, and the tranquility and equanimity. You can reach a certain stage in your meditation where you have that all the time, but you do have to sit down and meditate every day, because if you stop, over a few days or a few weeks, it will fade and disappear. But there are other changes that are permanent. And that's what we're really after. We're not concerned with the things that require that you have to be able to meditate to have. We're interested in the permanent changes that take place. Was that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a very important thing. That's a very important thing to recognize and to realize. I think some people have meditated and they've reached that point where they have great joy and tranquility and equanimity. And I think, okay, this is it. I've arrived. It's, you know, there's nothing more to do. And they might be fine, but if they get sick, they can't meditate for 2 months, they lose it all. Or, you know, everybody gets old and loses their health. If a person develops Alzheimer's, can't meditate anymore, they're going to lose that. Because if it's dependent upon meditation, if that's the only way to sustain it, then you lose the meditation and you lose it. But what this path is really about is the kind of transforming insight, understanding, that permanently changes the way our mind works, permanently changes the way we see things. And that, you can't lose that.
In the book, The Power of Now, mm-hmm. I kind of view his point specialized in, he say, human being tends to use the mind instead of sense, instead of like feeling. They use mind mm-hmm. more, like the mind cover everything, mm-hmm. cover your real, your true me, and your, just like it is cover your wisdom. Mm-hmm. So that's what I view the book, the lesson the book give me. Sorry, for people they don't read the book, they probably don't understand what I'm talking about.
That's
it's a good book.
It is. It's a good book. And I was very happy to see that somebody has translated it into Chinese.
Already transferred to Chinese.
Yeah, that was very good.
But I think English edition probably is better. Because the
you can watch a video of him. Yeah. It's very funny.
Already?
Oh, video? Actually, yeah, there's lots of videos of him, or DVDs. Yeah.
Really?
He's hilarious.
His biography, isn't
he? Oh, he just talks, and he's very funny. He's a very odd personality.
I was just going to say, just from my personal experience, there can definitely be a danger. If you know, you start meditating and you achieve these kind of good, nice, tranquil concentration, but you don't have the insights. And then if you stop, like that's what happened to me, my life changed and then I stopped. Mm-hmm. And then I actually degraded even to worse than I had been before I began meditating, you know?
Yeah.
It was really nasty. But the good part of it was when I went back to meditating, it was like much faster to get rid of those hindrances again, right? So there can be also kind of a danger there. And quite frankly, I wasn't aware of that, you know, the difference between the concentration aspect and the insight aspect. Mm-hmm. I had no clue.
I don't use the word dangerous. I have some experience. I think it's a process. You need to experience that.
Process.
But if you use dangerous, probably you scare them. No? It's a process. Yeah. I have experienced before.
I think it's important, though, that, you know, and I think you already mentioned it, but people need to be aware if you don't have lasting insights, you know, it's only your daily practice that's holding your hindrances at bay, right?
Yes, right. Yes.
And if you stop or you miss a couple days, you know, instantly you might find yourself reacting with anger in your, and then slowly, and you have to build it back, right?
That's right. Yes.
I hate that experience.
Same?
Yeah, yeah. Same. Mm-hmm. Very strongly. But it's good. It's a good challenge. When you get through it, everything will be good.
Okay. If you get that.
There's a name for what?
I guarantee you.
There's a name for this stage. You know, you said it's a process, and it actually is. It's part of the progress of insight.
Always.
The stage has the name. It's called knowledge of what is and is not the path.
Yes.
Okay. And it is the illusion that wonderful meditative states are the path, and they're not. Insight is the path. And so you too have mastered the knowledge of what is and is not the path.
I'm very glad to hear somebody has the same experience as me. When that happened, you are very worried.
Yeah.
And very afraid. But you believe this is right. It will be cool. It will be not good experience. Right now I say it. But that time I don't think it. Right?
Yes, Michael?
My question, the answer should be pretty obvious, but I'm curious to your response. So having the right companionship is the whole practice, and I'd like to hear you give what you think is the primary reason. It should be pretty obvious, but I'm just curious.
It should be pretty obvious. Well, actually, in the sutra, the words were noble companions. Noble is Aryan, meaning those people that have already achieved a certain degree of awakening. But yeah, the reason that it's important, you all know how much you're affected by other people, by the people who are around you. To some degree, it's one of our biggest problems, that we end up responding to the expectations of other people, and we will behave and sometimes speak and think in ways that reflect the companions that we associate with on a regular basis. It has a very, very powerful effect on us. So, just that by itself, if you take care to associate with people of the highest character and the greatest virtue and the best ethical values and the greatest wisdom, it cannot help but have a positive effect on you. And just the opposite is true. To the degree that you associate with people who lack ethics and virtue and wisdom, it's going to have a negative influence, and you're going to be struggling against that all the time.
Is it because, you know, our mindfulness, our clarity is not good, for a lot of the times, therefore we're subject to corruption? Because if our mindfulness is always good, then we know, hey, you know, this is what the way that they're behaving is not something I want to emulate.
Okay.
So. It seems like, you know, for most of us, including myself, the mindfulness is just not good enough to not be corrupted.
Yes, that's right. There is a point you reach where that's not a danger anymore. But until you reach that point, yes, you're going to be vulnerable to these corrupting influences.
But isn't it also just the whole idea of the world view? I mean, you know, what view you hold of the reality of, you know, perceived reality, that everything is separate or not. I mean, the interconnectedness or not.
Well, how do you relate that to what Michael was saying?
Well, that good companions or noble companions have a world view. And that you need that worldview reinforced.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But it's the shared worldview.
Because, I mean, the general, you know, like, I mean, Eckhart Tolle talks in his book a lot about how so few people, like, how, I mean, he's he's like funny because he's talking about how insane everything is. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, well, you know, we think somebody's insane, but like 95% of stuff, 99% is insane in a level that they don't understand.
That is a good illustration that when you're caught up in the common worldview, all of this insanity going on around you seems completely normal. it's only when you're able to step outside of that and see it from a different perspective, from more wisdom, that you actually recognize that, well, this is crazy. Well, this has been a good discussion. Now, if anybody else has a question that they really want to ask, I'll give you a chance. And then,
I don't know. I'm just kind of curious. In my life, I don't really associate. I kind of want, since I started practicing, all the people who are negative and whatnot just kind of faded away. You know, when you're not into those things, you're just not interested anymore. But I have my wife, for example. So, you know, at this point in her life right now, she's not very, very mindful, and she can kind of, you know, respond like to events in the regular fashion. So, you know, generally, I it doesn't affect me because I feel compassion because I know that she's suffering, right? I realize. But sometimes, you know, if you're not quick enough, that, you know, because that person's in your space, they can completely blow away your calm.
Yes.
Right? And I just keep telling myself I have to be compassionate because she's suffering. And, you know, everybody's suffering. I'm suffering. What can I do? Right? She knocks me. And it's not her fault, necessarily. I mean, you know, it just happens, right? Mm-hmm. Is there anything, other than practicing mindfulness, I guess there's not so much we can do about that.
Yeah, practicing mindfulness and, you know, one of the things we talk about, ideally you would be surrounded only by noble companions, but that's not always going to be the case. You can do your best to associate with the finest people, but the nature of life is that there's some people that, well, for example, you know, our own families. We're not going to cease association with our families because they're not on the same spiritual path that we are. And in your work, your career, you're going to associate with people. Maybe you live somewhere and you have neighbors. But the thing is, everyone has, as I would put it, everyone has a Buddha nature already. Everyone has good. And everybody has a part of themselves that wants to move that person in the right direction. And so one of the things you can do is to pay attention to that aspect of those of all of those people. See the best in everyone, because there is that in them. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about being in a relationship, being married, is it gives you the opportunity to exchange yourself for another. As long as you have this attachment to an ego self, and you're dealing with another person who has an attachment to the ego self, you have a wonderful opportunity to practice setting aside your own self-attachment and trying to replace that with the intentions for the best interests of your partner. So it's a wonderful situation to do that. If you do that, it's impossible if you do that that the other person won't respond in the same way. It's absolutely irresistible.
Okay.
What did you say?
I said I was tricked. No, I'm kidding. Sweet.
You were
tricked.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
out.
I think in the real world, it is always the expectation you expect, and your family member, your wife, your spouse, your kids, they all expect of you. And in the office, your colleagues probably have the expectation of you. And your client has a certain expectation of you. Even you yourself have the expectation of yourself. So try to reach that level of expectation that always make you struggle, you know, that make you cannot calm down, cannot, you know, that's the reason why someone push you to one end, and you probably push yourself to another end. And I think that's the reason why, you know, it's kind of difficult, you know. And I think probably that's the reason why meditation helps.
The reason why we're here. Yeah.
I think the as John say, the change your viewpoint permanent, the way you see things. So probably we can be our wife is our professor. And my daughter is my assistant professor, and my son is a teaching aide. All the client is my fellowship. So we teacher teach you, or you can the other way. They are incent. I'm not incent. Then who is incent? So I think the way, as John said, probably we can, right? I try to do so, you know. I learned something.
That's a good
idea. Yeah, so every time my daughter call me, I say, my professor call me. Because this is a big challenge. I'm ready. Mindful awareness.
It's true.
Care for my response. Otherwise, they'll feedback.
I feel like my family.
All right, really? They are teacher. Yeah. Yeah. All right. I practiced this about a couple of years. It's damage control. I don't say improvement or enhance your level, but damage control. To some degree.
Yeah.
It's okay. Share with you. So I made a professor.
You know, sometimes people say, how do you know if you're enlightened or not? My answer is, go home. So back to your family. You'll find out.
So sometimes my son daughter call me and say, Father, what do you want to do next? After this talking, I need a meditation. Sometimes not always. The way to check your inside permanent to build a sense.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably enough talking for tonight.
Okay. Yeah, let's share.
So I'll suggest that, you know, if you need to go to the washroom or to stretch, do so, but then we'll sit until the next bell rings, okay?
It's going to ring in 36 minutes. Okay.